Blog Talk Radio.
This is Lauren Litton, host of Quick Take Ohio, a pre-recorded podcast highlighting Ohio's juvenile justice news. A few weeks ago, we featured the National ACLU's work around ending the practice of solitary confinement. This was in conjunction with the launch of Children Law Center's campaign that asked the Ohio government to regulate and monitor the use of seclusion in adult and youth state correctional settings, detention centers, and residential treatment facilities. We discussed the components of that practice and how it is harmful, so I encourage you to listen to that podcast as a supplement to this one. As a quick reminder, solitary confinement can also be called seclusion, room confinement, or isolation, and typically refers to placing a kid in a small windowless cell for extended periods of time. Since that aired, there seems to be even more national attention on the subject. This week, the state of Illinois announced that they entered into a settlement agreement, ensuring that kids spend at least 8 hours a day outside of their cell. And today, we're highlighting a new toolkit developed by the Council of Juvenile Correctional Administrators, which we will refer to as CJCA, designed to assist leadership of youth correctional facilities in changing cultures that rely on isolation as a behavior management tool. Joining us to give an overview of this tool is Ned Loughran, who is the founder and executive director of CJCA. He has 43 years of administrative experience in the state juvenile corrections and nonprofit world. Welcome, Ned.
Thank you very much, Lauren. It's great to be on today.
So, as a national organization, CJCA represents CEOs of youth correctional facilities across the country. Why did CJCA decide to develop a toolkit on reducing seclusion or isolation?
Yeah. Just a little background. A small group of us founded CJCA 21 years ago. It was when many of the legislatures throughout the country were passing legislation that would make it easier to transfer kids into the adult system and also to give longer terms in the juvenile system. And there was really no voice of reason about what was working in youth corrections. So a small group of us, who I was running the Massachusetts Department of Youth Services, which is comparable to the Ohio DYS at the time, and we're talking now the late 80s and early 90s. So we decided to form a national organization to give some voice to us and actually to unite our members, because we were all spread all across the country and really did not know what the others were doing. And so we were probably reinventing the wheel in terms of programs and the rest. So that's really what led to our formation in the first place. And so ever since then, we've really tried to be reform-minded, even though some of the systems need reform from time to time. The way I see the whole use of isolation, it's something we've been opposed to from the very beginning. I used very, very little of it when I was commissioner at DYS, and I really required approvals up and down the line and monitoring so that kids were not languishing in their rooms and they were back into program as soon as possible. But I truly think one of the unintended consequences of the youth correctional agencies becoming more like the adult correctional agencies during that get-tough era on juvenile offenders, when all that legislation was passed in the mid to late 90s, I think the staff began to turn to the use of isolation as kind of their primary behavior management tool, that if the kid didn't obey them, they'd go in their room for a period of time, and no one was saying anything about it at the time. The use of isolation, obviously, if a kid is out of control and is in danger of hurting himself, herself, or another youth or staff, then obviously you need to probably put the kid in their room for a very brief period of time until the youth gets control of him or herself. And during that time, a staff ought to be working, especially a staff who has a good relationship with the youth, ought to be working with the kid to get the kid back into program. So that's about the only use we really sanction as an organization. But to use it as punishment, so you did X, Y, and Z, you got into a fight last week, so now there's a hearing, and you're going to spend 7 days in isolation. That's punitive, and that we're totally opposed to the use of punitive isolation, and we're really working with our jurisdictions to try to end that. So so that led us to develop a toolkit to help the jurisdictions do a better job and understand the benefits of not using isolation and what states have been able to move away from the use of isolation. And so that's what really led to putting the toolkit together.
Mm-hmm. And this toolkit really, it has many components, including an overview of the issue and research, action steps, and case studies. And during the development, CJCA came up with a position statement, which you sort of referred to already. How was this comprehensive toolkit developed?
Well, what happened was we have an annual leadership institute where all the directors of youth corrections are invited to it, and we spend 2 days on various topics. The very first one several years ago, we tried to come up with a common definition of recidivism, and we published a white paper on recidivism. The leadership institute that we held in Chicago in October of 2014, actually it was supported and funded by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, which has been a big supporter of CJCA through their Models for Change program over the years. We decided to make the reduction of isolation a central theme of the Leadership Institute, and we invited Robert Lissenby, the current administrator of the U.S. Department of Justice's Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention. We invited him to give a keynote talk and then also to lead a panel of four of our directors who actually have had all successfully reduced the use of isolation in their jurisdictions. We decided that the panel would be a good way of helping the other members to see what does work, what some of the barriers were that had to be overcome. And following the leadership, the panel, we actually broke all the members into working groups for the next hour, and they came back and reported on who was being successful at reducing isolation, who was still struggling, what were some of the barriers that had to be overcome. And we concluded the meeting the next day. We concluded the meeting with a roundtable discussion, and we actually put up the newsprint and filled it out and had notes being taken of, again, what are some of the steps that should be taken to reduce the use of isolation. And as we were concluding the meeting and the roundtable discussion, we resolved to develop a toolkit to do exactly that. And so we actually hired a writer who is very well versed in juvenile justice to take all our notes and newsprint and to do as much reading as possible. She read the ACLU toolkit on advocacy around reducing isolation that you referred to their national campaign earlier, and a lot of other information. Performance-based standards is a vehicle that actually was developed by CJCA to measure outcomes in facilities. We use the principles that PBS adheres to, and it went through a number of iterations, but we produced the toolkit that we're talking about today.
Great. We don't have a lot of time, but you mentioned, you know, some steps. I know the tool outlines 5 strategies. If you could sort of quickly name the strategies and maybe give one example of each to give our listeners an idea.
Sure. So the 5 strategies to reduce its use are that the agency really needs to adopt a mission statement and philosophy that reflects the rehabilitative goals. In the past, most agencies have a dual mission: protect the public and rehabilitate the youth. And the emphasis, as I said before, really got on protect the public, which is very, very important, no question about it. But somehow the rehabilitation slipped. So therefore, that really rehabilitation really needs to be emphasized, because that's why youths are in a juvenile agency and not an adult agency. The states that we feature in the toolkit, the states of Massachusetts, Indiana, Oregon, Illinois, these are the states that, and you mentioned that Illinois has just settled on some of the aspects of isolation. These are the states that changed their mission statements and changed their policies and procedures, and that's the second strategy, to develop policies and procedures for use and monitoring of isolation. If you don't have a policy governing the use of any practice in a facility, but we're using the example of isolation, the danger is that staff will take it into their own hands and use it any way they want to use it. You've got to have a policy and procedure. And a lot of the four jurisdictions I mentioned and many others, they've revisited their policies and procedures, and they've changed them and adapted them so that it really defines when you should use it and under what circumstances you should use it and for how long it should go on until there is kind of a progressive chain of command in terms of sanctioning it if indeed a youth needs to be in isolation longer than 15 minutes. The third is to identify data to manage, monitor, and accountable, and be accountable for the use of isolation. There are examples of facilities that used isolation and then they joined the performance-based standards initiative, where you do measure data and you report on your use of isolation in 2 months during the year, October and April. And when jurisdictions and staff see the data, they go, wow, I didn't know we were using it to that degree. So you really need to measure. You can't make a change unless you know what change you've got to make. And if you measure something, then you know what you've got to change. And so therefore, the measuring and collecting and measuring data and then developing an improvement plan to reduce the use of isolation, and you identify who's going to do what and when they're going to do it by, and then you monitor that plan, and then the cycle repeats itself. 6 months later, you collect the data again. Actually, we encourage they do it on a monthly basis, but for the purposes of the PBS reporting, 6 months later, they collect the data. They look to see if they've been able to reduce the use of isolation, and then they tailor the plan to do it further or maybe move on to some other topic. So that's the third, to identify and manage data. The fourth is to develop alternative behavior management options and responses. The way I look at it is a lot of jurisdictions don't have a behavior management program whereby they reward the positive behavior of the youth and they have sanctions that are short of isolation for dealing with the negative behavior, such as loss of privileges or things like that. And it's very important that there be a behavior management component of every single program. And then the last is extraordinarily important. The fifth is to train and develop staff in the agency mission, the agency's values, standards, goals, policies, and procedures. And again, the jurisdictions that have been successful in reducing the use of isolation have found that by training staff, staff begin to understand that there are ways to short-circuit the use of isolation and to come up with alternatives that kids understand they're being held accountable, but at least they're staying in the program and not being isolated from the rest of the population. So those are the five strategies that we, and a little explanation of each of the strategies that we have used.
Great. So in the interest of time, is there one or two promising practices that you would like to highlight or some challenges that you want to talk about? Because we know this isn't an easy task. As reforms are happening, correctional facilities are working with youth that have some very severe mental and behavioral health issues.
Right. I think a practice that is really growing around the country that ties into this, especially into the training of staff. So when the director, Mike Dempsey from Indiana, was on the panel at the Leadership Institute, he said that they trained the staff in what's called trauma-informed care. And this is a movement that is really gathering steam throughout the country. There is a recognition in the developmental development of youth that that many of the kids who come into the youth correctional system have experienced trauma in their lives. They've witnessed violence. They've been the subject of violence either in their home or their community. And much of their acting out behavior, the research is showing that much of their acting out behavior is a result of the trauma that they have experienced. So when they had the training in Indiana in trauma-informed care, many of the staff, especially the veteran staff, who sometimes are difficult to change their ways, said, we never realized that. We never understood that. And so therefore, they were very different. It doesn't mean they were coddling the juveniles, but they were understanding that there is a reason why a kid is acting out, and if you can deal with the symptom, deal with the underlying behavior of an acting out youth, then you have a better chance of changing the kid rather than putting the kid in the room. I know time is of the essence, but we had some former residents speak to our members in our last meeting in Long Beach, California, and this young woman who is now on the staff of what's called the Inside Out Writers Program in California. She said, I was a youth, now she's staff in this program. She said, I was a youth in the girls' facility in the California Youth Authority. She said, and my brother passed away. And when I got word of it, they put me in my room and isolated me from the rest of the residents because they were afraid I was going to go off. And she said, well, that was the worst thing they could have done. She said, because this just deepened my depression because I was alone and I didn't have anyone to interact with. Well, our directors, you could hear a pin drop in that room when that youth said that. She's now in her 20s, but she experienced that. And that's a concrete example that the use of isolation re-traumatizes many youth. And so I think the training in trauma-informed care has really helped in many jurisdictions, helped staff to see that it's not black and white when a kid acts out. It's layered because of the trauma that these kids have experienced in their lives. And so my conclusion is that isolation has very negative public safety consequences because kids are angrier when they leave than they were when they came in, if indeed they experience a lot of isolation. It doesn't reduce violence in facilities. It actually has something to do with fanning the flames, and it really, as I just said, it can harm a youth psychologically, physically, and developmentally when isolation is used.
Okay. Thank you so much, Ned, for appearing on Quick Take Ohio.
It's my pleasure.
For people who want to access the toolkit, they can go to cjca.net. It's also posted on the Children's Law website on the Stop Solitary Confinement page. To follow the campaign, you can go hashtag Stop Solitary OHUs. Thank you, Ned, again for appearing on Quick Take Ohio, and thanks to all our listeners.
Thank you, Lauren. My pleasure.